Well, no, by Sergeant Jack, except tomorrow. My man Ian on the board. We should have Mr. Will Michaels with a zero as well. SP futures down 525. NASDAQ futures down 20. Dow's down like 45. We got individual stocks not doing much. Lou, how are you, buddy?
Good morning, sir. So, a little different musical intro, huh?
Yeah, I was just noticing that. I was wondering where that came from.
I'm changing things up.
He's changing things up. He's turning.
I thought for a second I'd been placed on. I'd been placed on hold in the wrong universe.
This is Planet Stocks and Jacks right here. You know.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear it. I hope the Stocks and Jocks World Headquarters Breakfast Buffet is getting an upgrade as well.
Well, since there's no place open around here, it's kind of hard to have much of a buffet. Just as you thought how things were getting so much better at Chicago, we pulled the lots this morning. We're the only car there.
I'm sorry, say again.
We're the only car in the lot. So anybody who thinks that people are coming back to downtown Chicago by leaps and bounds, if I were you, I'd get the rose-colored glasses off because they are not. Little improvement,
let me
maybe. But
what I woke up to this morning at about 4:20, my phone buzzes and I'm going, oh God, somebody's sending me text messages. And it was not a text message; it was an alert from one of the cameras that I have mounted on my house up in the mountains. And lo and behold, four mountain lions go walking across my back porch.
Across the porch?
Yeah. I don't know what they were. It could well be that one of them got up there and triggered the camera, and they saw the light or something come on, and that attracted the other three. But we had had reports. The Homeowners Association sort of keeps track of reports of large carnivores, and a deer, a full-grown deer, was ripped apart just down the hill from us. And so everybody said, okay, we got the mountain lion back. And we're sort of on alert for it. But as far as we knew, it was only one mountain lion. Now it looks like it's actually four.
Are we talking about a mom and three little guys?
Could be a little parade of mountain lions across my porch this morning.
Wow. I only had I didn't really have an experience like that once, but I was in one of our boondoggles in Florida, Lou, when we had all the, I will say, the losers from the member firms. We used to take them out and spend a fortune on them, only to have them move the business out to another exchange. So it was not exactly money well spent. It's a story for another day. But we were golfing in Florida very early at this incredible, of course, hugely expensive course. This is back when I wasn't such a bad golfer. So I'm on the tee, and it's long par three, and all of a sudden somebody says, wow, look at that just ran across the green. And, of course, I was lining up my shot, so I didn't see the damn thing. And we went up there, and it was the dew was out. It was early in the morning. And the one of the guys in the know swears it was the tracks of a rare Florida panther. And they're nowhere near as big as a mountain lion, I don't think. And they're not a threat to a human, but, you wouldn't exactly like to wrestle one of them, but he wouldn't take you out like a mountain lion would, I don't think. But I mean, I guess there's Florida panthers still around too, right? There aren't very many.
I've never heard of a sighting of one, but one of the interesting things is that those animals must have been endemic back in the 1700s and 1800s when people started to move inland from the coast, because think of how many birds there are for mountain lion. So you've got and because people encountered them all over the country, and they got regional names. So you've got mountain lion, you've got panther, you've got painter, which I think is an Appalachian term, a southern term. You've got puma, you've got cougar. So these things were in a lot of different places and very wide ranging. Obviously an apex predator. I mean, the issue for us and for our neighbors up in the mountains here is dogs, obviously, because those things will kill dogs without any hesitation. And then you know, children and the enfeebled. And as one of the latter, you know, because of our age, I don't think anybody's going hiking up there now without carrying, you know, a handgun. So that sort of reinforces my my feeling
in some areas, though,
hiking alone in the woods anyway.
But depending on where you are, I mean, the food chain. If you're anywhere, say you're in the Bonanza, on the Bonanza set, the amount of territory one of those guys needed to call his own, it's pretty darn big. It wasn't like there were, you know, 50 of them per square mile. I mean, there might have been one per square mile. I mean, because basically he needed that much room just to be able to eat. I mean, there's not that much stuff around. I mean, it wasn't like those guys were all over the place. It's not like they're snakes in the Florida Everglades, so sitting right next to each other.
No, that's true. Or alligators, true. But they had such wide ranging territory. They apparently were spread, again, based on those regional names. Apparently, they were spread all over the country. I know they encountered them in the Appalachians, and obviously you encounter them still in the Rockies. But apparently, they were present not just in mountains, but you know, in large forested areas, and that was most of the time when
you hear of one arrived. You hear of one once in a while in the Midwest. I mean, it's these river systems. Don't move up and down. I mean, how much bigger? How big is a bobcat versus a mountain lion? I mean, a mountain lion, I know, is a lot bigger, but a bobcat's pretty good size. What are they, like 40 pounds?
I mean, a 40-pound bobcat's a pretty big bobcat. I think they're typically smaller than that.
But they eat mice and that kind of stuff,
the
right?
Size of a house cat.
But they're mice and rabbit kind of guys, right?
Yeah, they don't. Although I will, I don't know if you saw the video of that bobcat. I think it was a bobcat attacking that woman and her husband in the as they were getting into their cars one morning.
Wow! Really?
And the guy grabbing the bobcat, picking it up and throwing it on the front lawn. The video of this is from I think it's their Nest camera. But you know, the wife walks out, the husband walks out, puts a pan of brownies, which he's taking to work, on his car and his cup of coffee, and his wife walks between the two cars that are parked in the driveway, and you hear this horrible yowling, screeching, and the cat apparently jumps up on her back.
Wow.
She's got like a sweater on or something. The cat jumps up on her back, and you know, her husband goes into what I would refer to as, you know, caveman mode, races around the side of the car, grabs the cat, and you can see him in the video actually holding the cat up in the air. And he throws it on the lawn, and then in true, I think he's from the South. He's got a Southern accent, but in true Southern gentleman fashion, he pulls the handgun that he's concealed carrying and chases the thing. But bobcats typically don't get around people. They're very reclusive. It's unusual to see them. Mountain lions, not quite so reclusive. I mean, they're not
afraid.
No, they're not afraid. They stay away from people, but you know, if they encounter one, they're not necessarily going to back off.
Well, this is not the right week probably to have a police story, but they found a mountain lion up on the north side. Remember this story? You were still in the city.
Yes, I sure did.
The police are shooting at the thing, and one guy's on his cell phone telling his buddy how he's shooting at the mountain lion, and how, you know, he thinks he got it and so forth. Well, turns out, didn't two guys shoot people's air conditioners, and the city had to replace the air conditioners or something? They're aiming at the mountain lion, they shot the air conditioners. It was some absolutely bizarre story that the police didn't really want to get out, but it got out.
I mean, first of all, the idea that, you know, you can just cops or anybody else with a handgun at anything more than about, you know, 20 feet are super accurate is especially in a moment of crisis, is mistaken. I mean, the cops pull their guns, they're firing, you know, they're shooting until whatever it is stops moving, and they try to get, you know, they try to get sights on target, but it's hard. I mean, I practice with the stuff I've got, and if you've got to make a, if you've got to pull the weapon out and center it and shoot it in less than like a second or a second and a half, odds are the first shot you put out there is not going to hit the target or not going to go where you're aiming. And maybe then you can center sights on it after the first recoil, but it's hard to do. And if that thing's, you know, a ways away, and presumably they didn't get close enough to it to get you know, the first shot on target, that doesn't surprise me. I'm amazed they didn't put bullets through people's houses.
Well, they did the air conditioners instead.
The air conditioners are bad enough.
Yeah.
Which then leads into something I wanted to talk about, and I'll just give my opinion on this, and we can leave it. The Chauvin trial in Minneapolis, I think, you know, if you, and I'm going to come down and sort of the way I looked at the evidence and the way it was going. I mean, my immediate thought was that there was plenty of reasonable doubt and a jury that was actually acting in accordance with the instructions that it was given would find reasonable doubt, could easily find reasonable doubt for all three charges, but should at least find reasonable doubt on two of the three. And I think it was obvious from the timing, the amount of time the jury took to do it. In fact, I suspect they walked in, looked around, and said, you know, we don't want our neighborhoods to burn down, and we don't want to be doxxed, and we don't want our names out in the press. So let's get this guy convicted. And I'm guessing they took a vote within the first 5 minutes, convicted him on all three, and then said, well, we can't just walk back into the courtroom and say, look what happened. By the way, they have paperwork to fill out too. And so they sat on it for at least a day, at least a night, and then gave their decision. I don't think Chauvin got a fair trial, but I also understand in the jury system that we have that there are lots of situations where fair trials don't result. That's what the appellate process is for. I hope that the verdicts get overturned, because I think this guy didn't get a fair hearing. I don't think the case should have been heard in Minneapolis or in Hennepin County. Somebody made a comment that I thought was pretty accurate. Imagine, because the jurors had to walk through this gauntlet of, you know, protesters, 50, 60, 70 protesters screaming every day as they went in. And this guy said, imagine if the situation was reversed and you had a black defendant and there were 50 Ku Klux Klan members sitting out front screaming as the jury came in every day. You know, do you think that, is that a trial that you would think would give a fair result? And I don't. But I also understand the jurors not wanting to be in a situation where, you know, they basically look at each other and say, well, we just set the city on fire.
We have
a mob. I think we have a mob kind of mentality rule here. And I'm hoping that this thing gets reversed on appeal. I don't know if it will be. I mean, you know, state court appellate judges have to live in their neighborhoods too. But I think it would have been a much cleaner result, at least for me, had this guy been tried in Duluth or Marshall or some other town where they weren't facing the kind of pressure that they were getting in this one.
First of all, Lou, you're not supposed to somewhat agree with me. We're on air, right? We're supposed to be fighting. I had a call actually last night from a couple of my our better listeners, and one of them was from Minneapolis. And everybody's criticism of what happened. We had Brendan and Kevin on yesterday, and they found no issue with the verdict. Right? I mean, and actually, my guy from Minneapolis said that this guy has been pretty much an awful policeman from day one. Probably never should have been on the force. He had multiple issues with stuff like this, and finally somebody died.
But nothing, but nothing related to race.
In fact,
there's not a scintilla of evidence that this thing
is our African American guest from the show, Eric May, who was a policeman in He was a reporter in Washington way back in the day when crystal meth first came in, and he said the one thing that a lot of black people don't understand is that cops are just as nasty to the white people in a lot of these cases.
Yes.
If you get a bad cop, you're just a bad cop. He goes, the worst tuning up I've ever seen was white cops on white people. He said they did it to think that they only did it to black people. He says is ignorant. If you're a bad cop and you're a mean guy, you do it to everybody. And anyway, without going through the pluses or minuses of it, I have the sort of the same issue, Lou, in it. And whenever I bring this up, be it over an adult beverage, over a cup of coffee, or whatever, everybody pretty much laughs at me and thinks I'm a nut, because they love the outcome and they like the idea of the word example being made of somebody.
That just
really bothers me, to be honest with you, because I don't ever want to see anybody made an example of. Because when I was on the board of the CBO,
I'm committed professionally to the process. The result doesn't matter. I'm committed to the process. And if the process is tainted, then I'm going to take the position that this was a mistake. But it takes a lot of courage and a lot of intestinal fortitude on the part of one of those jurors to say, I don't care what the result is. I'm more interested in the process. And it looks like the process here overcharged this guy. And this looks like a civil case rather than a criminal case. And I think there's reasonable doubt as to what killed him. I think there's reasonable doubt as to whether this cop was using procedures that he'd been, trained in versus running off on his own. And so I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to vote to convict.
Well, I happen to think that's a very
special person that does that.
Well, I actually think that one of those charges was legit. I mean, you can't, because when somebody ends up dying, Lou, it's like the people who put the guy in the back of the paddy wagon in Baltimore, not with a seatbelt, and drove around and did their best to rough the guy up in the back. You know what, Lou? When somebody dies, boy, you know what? It crosses a line. it may not have been your intention, but boy, oh boy, you got to be careful when you're doing.
I agree. And you saw exactly what happened in Baltimore, though, with what I think should have happened in Minneapolis, and that is they overcharged it. It wasn't a criminal case. It was a civil case. And in the civil case in Minneapolis, Mr. Floyd's family, nothing replaces Mr. Floyd, obviously, but there was a remedy given in the civil case. And so, to a certain extent, the negligence issue has been resolved, at least in my mind.
Well, if somebody's a pain in the ass when you go to arrest them, I'm not going to say that people aren't people. And when you shove the guy in the back of the squad car, the shove might be a little more than it ought to be. But Lou, once you're dead, there's no coming back, bud. I mean,
But like I said, I think this case was shot through with reasonable doubt, but that's all right. This is a jury process that we trust it to a jury, and we understand. I mean, those of us who try cases understand that you are going to get jurors whose decisions are not, they're going to listen to the instructions of the judge, and then they're going to forget about them the minute they walk into the jury room.
I think they
allow their emotions or their feelings to take over, and I've sat through 30 mock juries where we tried a case, albeit in a shortened way, we tried a case to practice jurors and listen to their comments, because really what you're trying to do, the best you can do as a trial attorney, is negate the emotional impact of the case that you're dealing with and try to get the jurors to assess the case on the facts and the law. And if you can get that, then you've done a pretty good job, at least as a defense attorney.
Well, my question to you, the legal part, we can sort of debate the outcome and so forth, till hell freezes over. The fact is, the outcome is the outcome. But what are the guidelines for, I'll go back to the one that I to this day, again, even though everybody's, the reason why I feel so bad about the example crap, and I use that word intentionally, is when I was on the board of the SIBO, they'd find a guy who did something. Somebody that wasn't a member firm guy, it'd be some guy on the floor. And they would say, we need to make an example out of him so other people know not to do it anymore. Not only did it, was it ignorant, it never worked. If you were some schmuck on the trading floor doubling his fine thinking that one of the member firms like Merrill Lynch or Smith Barney was going to take notice and think they're next, they knew exactly what was happening. You're spanking this guy because you wanted them to notice because you're never going to spank them. I mean, they understood it. The people on the board were the idiots. The idea that somebody actually that if all of a sudden, you find Lou Michaels for going down the street, to think that Jeff Bezos at Amazon is going to say, hey, I better be careful. Look what they did to Lou. That is so stupid. I can't go there. I mean, it has absolutely the opposite impact. But my point is, I'm going to go back to the Blagojevich thing, a little less controversial. The man has a hung jury. And there's one person. Now, we end up getting the addresses out. Now, my buddy from Minneapolis claims that all the addresses that his jurors got out. So they end up getting out. Now, the person who voted for there was the hung jury for the Blagojevich thing, people are demonstrating on his lawn. People, the press is there.
Oh, I know.
How the hell could you ever have that second trial here? Are there no guidelines where a judge is going to say, I mean, right now these judges have more ego than anything else. Sequester this? No, I'm the right guy. Should it be in the next county? No, this is my day in the sun. I want this trial. I mean, are there no guidelines that say, wait a minute, this can't be here? I mean, who's kidding? No.
Yes, there are guidelines, but it's an art, not a science. What the judge is trying to do is to, when the judge makes a decision like that on a change, most change of venue motions are denied, and they don't provide a basis for appeal either. This may be one of those rare cases where it does, and the reason for that is you had a concerted effort by rioters and protesters in the community to attack the jury, to threaten the jury, and to threaten the city with mob violence if they didn't get the verdict that they wanted. And this was reinforced by, a congresswoman from California who showed up there. It was reinforced by the President of the United States. It was reinforced by the mayor of Minneapolis. And so if you're a juror, you're living in this environment, and again, you're walking the gauntlet of these screaming demonstrators who are basically saying, we're going to burn your house down. And if you're a juror, you understand, at least in the back of your mind, that notwithstanding the fact that you're supposed to be anonymous, you realize that the Minneapolis Star has published all of your biographical background in the paper. So your name's not there, but anybody with half a brain who has any association with you can figure out that you're on there, and they're not under any constraints not to put your name out there. If you're a juror who stands up in that court, in the deliberation room, and says, you know what, this guy had three times the fatal level of fentanyl in his system, and I know we heard some testimony that he was such an addict that may not have killed him, but we also heard testimony saying that that's almost certainly what killed him. As far as I'm concerned, there's reasonable doubt, and I'm not going to hold the officer accountable for that criminally. If you stand up in that deliberation room and say that as a juror, you have a very good and reasonable fear that your name's going to be in the press within 2 hours. And I mean, you can't conduct a jury trial the way. Oh, and I missed one other step. the city of Minneapolis, as the jurors were being selected, puts a well-publicized settlement for $27 million out there.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'm an appellate court and I'm being honest, I'm saying to myself, you couldn't have tried this. This case should never have been tried in Hennepin County.
I don't, Lou, I have two questions that it brings up. The first one is, I'm going to go off topic here. I don't know if you heard about the Eddie Burke situation yesterday. We got a minute here, but I'll set it up for you. Evidently, they had a wiretap on him, right? And, you know, they had for a while.
Right.
Not saying they should have or shouldn't have. Well, evidently, they leaked yesterday that he had anti-Semitic remarks on the wiretap. No, I'm going to say it wouldn't surprise me that he lobs a few of those out. I have no idea whether he did or he didn't. But how the hell does that?
The worst that they had.
How does that become public? How does a wiretap? Well, how do people at the FBI not get fired over that? I mean, how does a wiretap become public?
Chief, look at the stuff that was being leaked out of DOJ during the Trump administration by senior level DOJ officials as part of that soft coup attempt against the president, and no accountability for that. You know, none. I mean, Comey got fired, but I'm not sure he was the leaker. Certainly the people underneath him who were doing this stuff, there was virtually no criminal accountability for any of that. People got fired, but that was the end of it. I think we are coming to the position, and I hate to say this, but we are reaching the position where we have to look at our executive law enforcement agencies as purely political entities.
Well, that's what they all are.
They're not interested in the pursuit of justice.
They always were to a certain extent. But, Lou, we got to go to break. SP Futures down 4, NASDAQ Futures down 21. We'll pick this up when we come back.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatory anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tamayo. He's Ian Kidwell on the board. We have Mr. Lou Michaels with us as well. S&P futures down 450. NASDAQ futures down 22. We were up pretty huge yesterday after two down days, so we made a lot of that back yesterday. Dow futures are down 9 over in Europe. Bounce back here, but not that much. They were down like a couple percent yesterday. DAX up 86.6%. FTSE now up 7.1%. CAC around up 47.8. Over in Asia, Nikkei, which is down 2%, is up 2.3 today. The bounce up 679. It's a huge day. Shanghai down 7.2%. Hang Seng up 133.5%. Again, the Shanghai was unchanged yesterday, even though the Nikkei was down 2. So they're traveling to a beat of a different drummer over there, the Shanghai and the Nikkei, for whatever reason. Just a way of review. Yesterday, the Dow was up 316. So a big day, making up for Monday and Tuesday, pretty much. S&Ps were up 38. It's a full 1%. And NASDAQ was up 163. That's 1.2%. Bonds today unchanged at 1.57. The Bund minus 0.25, which is, again, keeps creeping towards zero. Japan is going the other way, though. Positive 0.07, which is lower than the 0.11 it's been for, like, a long time. Oil down 33 cents, 61.02. Brent down 41 cents, 64.91. Natural gas down 2 cents, 266. RBOB unchanged at 197. And we've got gold is down $6, but $1,787, and almost made it to $1,800 yesterday. Maybe today. Silver down 11 cents over the big rally yesterday. Copper unchanged at $4.28. And our favorite crypto, Bitcoin, not my favorite, but everybody's favorite, down $534 at $55,037. Everybody thinks 55,000 is a technical number. I don't know if I need to get that in a Bitcoin, but if it is, it's right there. Ian, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Boy, hockey, I gave up on it. I guess I shouldn't have last night.
Yeah, the Blackhawks won versus the Predators 5-4. You were saying they went into overtime?
Yeah, they I think it was the first, maybe second period. The Hawks are pushing. There's like 15 seconds left. They don't score, and there's like 5 seconds left. And one of the Predators gets the puck, looks up at the clock, realizes he has time, was racing down. I'm thinking, don't let the Hawks fall asleep here. The guy jams one in with like a second left, and I'm going, that's it. I can't watch these guys. And sure enough, they came back and won in overtime.
All right.
I was watching the Cubbies instead.
Yeah, the Cubs. Cubs also had a pretty exciting game. They won against the Mets 16-4. You don't see that.
They've scored
often.
More runs in the last like four games than they did in the first 15 or some ridiculous number.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And the White Sox game was postponed, and the Bulls lost to the Cavaliers 105-121.
For a big game against Boston, and they pooped the bed last night against the Cavaliers, which is, they're just not going anywhere, I don't think.
Speaking of Cubs, if you're driving in Chicago, look out for that 640 Cubs game. Otherwise, the roadways are clear, no accidents. For the weather in Chicago, it's going to be a high of 56 and cloudy. And in Phoenix, it's going to be a high of 83 and sunny. So, nice weather today in Phoenix.
So, Lou, how much would they have to pay you to go to one of the Cub games last night or the Cleveland game the other night when it's like 30 degrees and windy?
I mean, baseball's a tough game to watch in really cold weather because the action's kind of slow and I don't get, there are moments of excitement, but they're not many and they're spaced out. At least watching a football game, you know, you're up and down, or maybe even a soccer match, you're up and down and cheering, and there's action that gets you, your energy level up a little bit to stay warm. I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think of the most miserable I've ever been at a sporting event. It was probably one of the old Viking games where they were playing when it was like 5 degrees or something like that at kickoff. But I mean, to watch a baseball game in weather, you know, below 40.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not feeling it.
No, it's a, plus there's no rest for the wicked. No attempt to be a little quicker between innings or anything like that. I mean, it is a studio event. There's no doubt about that.
Well, yeah, and I mean, as much, don't get me wrong, as much as I enjoyed going to watch a game at Wrigley, you know, or at whatever they're calling Comiskey these days, I always think of baseball. I want to be watching a baseball game in a t-shirt and shorts. You know, I don't want to be watching a baseball game in you know, fleece-lined jeans and a parka.
Yeah, it's a, well, there's no, the idea of having night games in April is bizarre in northern cities. I mean, it just is, but that's where the money is, Louis.
Yeah.
You gotta follow the money, and I mean, you know, the straw that breaks the camel's back. I mean, I won't go anymore. I'll never go to Notre Dame game after
the Twins. The Twins are what? They're the northernmost team,
right?
Do they? I mean, I don't know how cold their games get, but that's an outdoor stadium, and I mean, you can freeze your tail off in April in Minneapolis. Trust me.
Well, was it 2 years ago? They got snowed out like 2 weekends in a row, right? They had how many?
Right.
Although
if the Rockies had been playing here yesterday, they would have been snowed out. We got another inch and a half or so of snow, rapidly falling temperatures on top of a 4.5 inch or 5 inch snowfall on Monday. So we've had a cold run here. It's supposed to warm up, but we're like 25 degrees below normal here in Denver for this week.
We were talking before the break about, you know, where law enforcement and where the politics is all heading, and I can see it in my industry, the things that are enforced and the things that aren't, and the politics behind that. And, to the point where some firms just seem to get bigger and bigger and bigger and never get, I trade options for clients all day long and trade stock and whatever, sometimes some futures, but the markets, I mean, I still, because I've been at it for so long, and people essentially pay me to be able to figure out what's going on in the market and to get things done when maybe other people can't. I mean, that's what, you know, I mean, they hire you to be the attorney because they don't know how to be an attorney. Well, I mean, my stuff that I, stocks that I can trade in on a daily basis continues to get smaller and smaller. And I look, even we had much earnings stuff the last few days, and I look at these things and there'll be, here's a stock where the markets are $4 wide and they haven't traded yet. Well, that's an illegal market. I mean, on a trading floor, I mean, you would have gotten written up for that and maybe fine. But now that there's only three or four firms making all the markets, the chances of those guys ever getting spanked for something like this is like zero. I mean, the entire...
Unless, Chief, unless somebody, they run afoul of somebody who decides, today I'm going to enforce the law against that firm to smack them for doing whatever.
There's no way that anybody has the stones to go up against the Citadel at this point, when everybody else is getting millions of dollars in payment from these people. I mean, it's causing the whole industry to be the way it is. I mean, there's no person that's big enough to do that. They've gotten that big. We're talking about four people. Four firms, four or five. I mean, where it used to be thousands of people. But I mean, you look around and at your law enforcement, and you know, Matty Weber just bought a condo, and good for him. I mean, great guy. I mean, he and his wife are terrific people. The world should be good for them. I mean, they're good people. And he's telling me, Chief, why the hell do they keep asking me where I got the down payment? I mean, we've worked for it for 5 years and put it in the bank. I mean, we have to let them know where we got every nickel. We got a signed affidavit saying we didn't borrow it from our parents. I mean, who the hell cares? Why is it their business? We're not talking about law enforcement. We're talking about the law enforcement has done nothing but jam stuff down the system to where you know, if we get a client.
Well, no, we are using our, all of these executive agencies now as arms of law enforcement. That's what's happening.
But I'm saying they're jamming it down.
I mean, there was a move for a while to require, if you were going to be a federal contractor, to require you to state on the record any instances where you had violated, you know, any state or federal law involving discrimination or pollution or a couple of other areas. And somebody had the, I mean, my immediate reaction was, well, that violates the self-incrimination clause or, you know, the Fifth Amendment. You can't force people to do that as a matter of getting a contract. And somebody finally stood up and said, this is a stupid idea and it's probably unconstitutional and you shouldn't be doing it. But there's a huge willingness on the part of our lawmakers and our people who were supposed to be enforcing this stuff to simply tell businesses, look, if you want to move money, if you want to buy another company, if you want to merge, we're going to require you to confess to anything that you've done in the past so that we can hang you for it later on if that's what it takes. It's astounding.
But why do people, but the thing of it is, Lou, it's not like people, you know, I know you guys don't like it when I use my Nazi Germany references, but one of the people look at what happened over there, and obviously you see, you know, concentration camps and all kinds of really horrible stuff. But I think what has to happen, but maybe what people should realize is that this was a 10-year plan on these people. I mean, how you want, you didn't just show up day one and wing somebody out of their house and throw them in a boxcar. I mean, this was a 10-year. You just keep pulling back just a little bit of somebody's rights, and if it's, the gradualism is such that people don't even notice that after a while, and when somebody breaks into their young adulthood at age 22, and they don't even realize how slowly this has come since they were age 12. I mean, you look at young people now; they have no idea that nobody should have the ability to ask you that question. I mean, when you look at the Deutsche Bank issue of a few months ago, where they obviously are dealing with a bunch of money launderers, because look at how many people that they've had to file exception reports to based on, just for people who, you know, don't know, if somebody opens up an account at PTI, it's our responsibility, according to somebody, to check you out at Interpol. Now, a guy comes in,
right,
signs up an account.
Oh, yeah, they're asking you to become a law enforcement agency.
But if the guy is an international no goodnik, how does that become PTI's problem? I mean, the interesting part is they're going to come after us. But the idea with the Deutsche Bank, it was every headline in every paper, and it was all over the bumps at CNBC that don't read the whole article. What they were on Deutsche Bank about, Lou, was actually filing the proper paperwork when somebody moved too much money, when somebody, the exception report, that somebody would, now if somebody ships money somewhere from PTI, it's not exactly the way they're supposed to do it, we have to file an exception report. We help out law enforcement. I mean, why we have to do that, I have no idea, but we do. So what they did was, because Deutsche Bank had filled out so many of these things, essentially did what they were supposed to do, law enforcement said, well, you must be hanging around with a bunch of money launderers, because look how many reports you filed. They didn't take the reports and investigate them like they're supposed to. They just said, look at the volume. Something must be wrong with you guys. I mean, Lou, why is it? I mean, I think you can't blame the listeners. You can't blame a person and say, hey, you know, Ian, instead of studying and doing what he's doing and trying to learn and trying to work and doing the things that a young guy's supposed to do, no, you're supposed to be watching out for this other guy. Well, isn't that what I pay police to do? Oh, no, they don't want to do that anymore. That's your job.
Well, it's I hearken back in the late 1980s. I was a military attorney prosecuting a lot of drug cases in New Mexico and some other places. And I went to a wedding, and there was a judge at the wedding, and he found out that I was a about a prosecuting attorney, and I was doing all this work. And he said, what do you think about sort of long-term impact of the drug war? And I said, well, I mean, one of the things that I don't like is that we're not quite at the moral panic level we were of the child sexual abuse scandal in the late 80s, but we're sort of moving in that direction. And he said, I guarantee you that the war on drugs is doing more damage to our civil liberties than anything, any impact that the actual drug use is having in terms of our quality of life. And he said the echoes of the erosion of our constitutional rights against search and seizure and self-incrimination that are occurring as the result of law enforcement's efforts to try to put a dent in the drug trade are monstrous and are going to be, those echoes are going to continue for decades. And he's absolutely right. I mean, look at the, you know, if you want to move, what is it, more than $10,000 in cash, you basically need a federal court order and you fall under scrutiny, automatic scrutiny of law enforcement agencies from your local police all the way up to the feds. And if you take the time and trouble, if you have to move a large amount of cash, and you take the time and trouble to move it in increments so as not to run afoul of the law, that is considered a violation of the law and activity that warrants your investigation. And on top of that now, Chief, and this story broke yesterday, the Postal Service has been used by, I guess it started with the Obama people, but maybe not, has been used to run and is running a surveillance operation, a domestic surveillance operation on American citizens on social media. Based on what?
Somebody's idea that wouldn't it be nice if we had all this information? I mean, Lou, they've got stuff from the Illinois Tollway Authority where they have towers not on the tollway that are picking up your passcode under the incredibly stupid guise that if the tollway's crowded and people leave the tollway, they want to know what other routes they go to. Anybody believe that story? For God's sake, I got a bridge for sale for you. I mean, what? But it's
so
just
the iPass or whatever they call it, iPass trackers are tracking you off the tollway.
Yeah, in some spots.
Oh, great.
Yeah, but you know the weird part of it is
your phone. Your phone gives constant GPS data. At least you could turn that off.
Well, that's amazing. The weird part is we have a city now, and I of course I've got nothing but feedback from everybody when I said Chicago has more cameras than virtually anybody in the world other than London. Well, it turns out that the people were correct, that there is some cities in China, duh, and like Venezuela or someplace that has more cameras.
Well, London has a huge CCTV system.
Yeah, so it's like London and then us. Like in, I'll say the real world. I mean, I'm not counting China. I mean, if we started counting China as a communist country, compared ourselves to that, that would say volumes in itself, right? But we have expressway shootings like every other day. And yet, they're not telling me, but it's not like, oh boy, it's a good thing we had this camera here. We arrested the guy half hour later. They're not even helping, Lou. I mean, look what happened to this kid in Pilsen. I mean, I'm a strong proponent. I mean, as a man whose family had police, and my dad was a policeman, of course, he died around his fourth.
Is this the Toledo shooting?
I don't think it's Toledo, but that's close to the name. Is that his name, okay. Toledo? I mean, the 13-year-old kid.
The 13-year-old kid, yeah. Was carrying the gun and then threw it away at the last minute.
Yeah, well... So,
yeah, okay.
So I mean, I've been around police in my whole life. My family, my uncle's a policeman. Wherever my stepfather's father was, he was a policeman. So, I mean, there's people that I know. And I look at this and I'm horrified by what I'm seeing. Now, this thing in Pilsen, again, just from what I've been able to cobble together, they have these things now where they listen for gunfire. Now, who got this contract?
Sure, Yeah. The shot location system that's been in place for at least 10 years, maybe 15.
All right, so we give this contract to somebody, right? So we get this thing where there's shots fired. Now I think, the whole thing has not been presented to me, but it appears that a couple cops show up. right? And they see a couple of people running, and off they go down the alley after them. Now, first of all, why there's no backup at this point, I have no idea. Well, I mean, this is fraught with peril. Two people with their guns drawn running down the alley, thinking the other two people have guns, and oh, by the way, have already discharged them, so they're like really bad people.
Knowing the other two people at least had a gun. Yeah. Fired at
well, but you're going to be putting two and two together that these are the people that were heard on the, I'll use the term microphone or camera, whatever the hell it is. So now you've got this situation where you've got a city that's loaded with policemen. Now, why only two people show up? I have no idea. Why there's not backup? Why there's not? As to you pulling your gun out with your finger on the trigger, running down the alley after these people, nothing could be more fraught with peril. Nothing could be an accident waiting to happen like that. I mean, I just know that from what police. Now, why there aren't three other squad cars there? Maybe because they run the other way. I don't know. The lack of coordination is just mind-boggling to me. So, sure enough, they get one of the guys. He's 13 years old. He wings the gun away, and the guy shoots him. Now, it's a split-second decision. If you look at the last piece, like on a replay at second base, it's fairly obvious that if you just looked at the last frame or two, that the kid does not have a gun in his hands. But you knew he just had a gun, and you also know that the hands went up, and you've got your finger on the trigger, and you're pointing at him, and guess what? You let one fly, and the kid dies. And the policeman's horrified that the kid dies. He tries to bring him back. It's a horrendous situation. He's 13 years old. Parents don't seem to have any sort of problem with the kid running around with a gun at 13 years old in the middle of the night. I mean,
his nickname was what? Little Homicide?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just a horrible situation. But this is what people should be looking at all the time. I mean, I mean, when I go to get, I went to the South Side to get my car fixed a while ago.
Chief, you've got, for some reason, and I don't understand why the community jumps on these kinds of cases, but you've got that case in, what is it, Columbus? With the 15-year-old girl about to fatally gut another girl in a on the front lawn of her foster home, and the cop shows up. You see the cop's hand go up to try to calm everybody down initially, and then he sees this girl with a looks like a 6 or 8 inch blade in her hand, about to stab her housemate, and so he shoots her. I mean, in a split second, that's what he's got. He pulls his gun because he knows that somebody's got a knife. And he sees the knife about to go out and get plunged into this person, and so he shoots her. And suddenly this is oh my God, this is an unwarranted police shooting. And I'm going, no. Go back to Toledo. I mean, the kid in Chicago, if you want at least a more questionable shooting to raise hell about. But this was a clean case of...
You've got deadly
force about to be used against somebody, and the cop intervenes.
But we don't need a whole bunch of people dying to get on TV, to get their face on TV, opining on how this is. I mean, from what I see happening, Lou, and I'm not.
Chief, your gal Valerie Jarrett.
I know. Well, I'm Chicago-born and bred,
jumps in and says the cop should never have intervened with a gun in a knife fight.
Well, we are not very good at picking our leaders right now. We haven't been for a while. I mean, it's not her. I mean, you go back and look at the people we've had, you know, running us for the last 20 years. I mean, there hasn't been a star amongst them. At the mayor level, at the governor level, at the president level. And why is that? I mean, what I'm saying, Lou, is you look at what's happening here in Chicago, and it's got to be other places. I just see here. You have the terrific guy, African American, retired with a lieutenant in the fire department, that got shot and killed in the carjacking incident right where I used to live, 115th and Western. Clearly, what's happening now is we have this juvenile system and the other system. I couldn't begin to tell you what the difference is, but the gangbangers, for lack of a better term, are jamming the nasty stuff down to people that are now juveniles, and it's been happening for a while.
Sure.
And so the kid who shoots this African-American retired fire guy who's just got a family and grandkids, just a regular guy that deserves to live, for God's sake. Now that kid's was what, 17, 16? Now he's Now, clearly this is happening, and now we've got this 13-year-old somewhere else. What are we going to do about it? And it's not all about coming after the one cop or coming after... what are we going to do about this? Clearly this is... And are we going to try these people as an adult? I don't know if that's a solution. But can you rehab? I mean, obviously, I'm a Catholic raised. The idea is that you're supposed to be able to rehab anybody. Can you really rehab a 13 or 14-year-old that's already committed 3 or 4 murders? I don't know, Lou. I mean, I have no idea. I'm not a psychologist. But clearly, there needs to be some people in a room saying, what are we doing right now? Should we change? Is there any way we can deal with this? Is there anything we can do to make it better? I don't see anything like that, Lou. That's my issue.
More importantly, I don't see anything from the community saying, we got to fix this ourselves or whatever. What I see is you've got to lower standards so that you know, and eliminate meritocracy so that we can get more of our kids into high performing schools. You've got to lower sentencing. You've got to lower policing so that we're not arresting as many of these guys. I mean, you remember the whole deal about
Lou,
trying to deal with the
guy. We have Mr. Hal Snark coming on. We have to put this off till next week, bud. It'll still be with us, I'm sure. I guarantee you that our people in power will not solve these problems by next week.
I agree.
All right. Okay. Take care of yourself. And by the way, don't go try and wrestle that cougar, please.
No.
SP Futures down 450, NASDAQ Futures down 27. Be right back, Professor Helsner.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. Do you know when the unofficial start of real estate season is in the Chicago area? It's actually right after the Super Bowl. Yep, it's the time when the guys will finally get off the couch and the families start looking for homes in the area. Now, interest rates also have been hovering around 4%, and the selection of properties are great. And if you're a first-time home buyer, there is an Illinois program that allows you to purchase a home for only 1% down. And that also applies to anyone who hasn't owned a home in the past 3 years. So if you're thinking about it, this is the perfect time. Call or email me, and I will send you a free list of homes designed to your specifications in your area. My phone number is 708-349-3456, or you can email me, Audrey Johnson at Realtor.com. That's Audrey Johnson at Realtor.com.
Look at them yo-yos, that's the way you do it. You play the guitar on the MTV. That ain't working, that's the way you do it. Money for nothing.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Lord, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Mr. Ian Kidwell on the board. SP Futures down 5.25, NASDAQ Futures down 34. Pausing a little bit after a big up day yesterday. Do we have Professor Hal Snar? Professor, how are you? Welcome back.
You know, the semester's winding down, and it's been a rough one.
God, it's been a rough year, bud. And
yeah.
By the way, Lou just had three... mountain lions walk across his patio. Are you jealous being in Utah?
What do you have? Walk across the lawn?
He lives up on, lives right near Cripple Creek in Colorado, and this morning his alarm went off, his motion detector, and he looked out, and there was a mountain lion and three little ones walk right across his patio.
Go Cougars!
Yeah. Go Cougars! And, wow, that would be enough to...
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. So how are you? Tell me what, have you taught in class, out of class, at home, not taught? What have you been doing?
Well, I've offered my students a mix where you could be in the classroom or you could just participate via Zoom. And because I designed my class to be the same whether you're in the classroom or you're on Zoom, a lot of students have chosen to, almost all, have chosen to participate via Zoom. Sorry.
No problem.
My alarm just went off.
Maybe it's the Cougars. Maybe it's the mountain lion. Yeah, it's the mountain lion in the backyard, like Lou.
So that's what they've done. And I have a class at 8 o'clock in the morning on Mondays that meets once a week on Monday. And so, you know, most college students are going to take up the option to, you know, watch class in their pajamas on Monday mornings. And then I have another class that meets at 6 o'clock at night. And, you know, who wants to be on campus at 6 o'clock at night? And then I have an MBA class on Friday nights. It's my fifth class of the semester, and it meets from 6 to 9:20 on a Friday night, and it's in business analytics. So I think most students have just decided that, you know, if it's available on Zoom, we'll just go Zoom. So
what exactly is business analytics?
Oh, man, it's pretty fascinating. I've been doing it for, you know, I did a lot of that stuff in my economic research where, you know, you're combining data sets with joins and unions, you know, you're making your research tables or your data tables wider or longer with these things called joins and unions. And I've been doing it for decades. And we had a professor leave to go to Chicago to be the head of data analytics at Charles Schwab there. And there was an opening to teach applied and introductory business analytics. And the way I teach it, you know, the first week, it's a 7-week course. I teach these algorithms in a thing called Python where people can use these algorithms to scrape data off HTML tables, or they can use APIs to get data directly from the Federal Reserve's economic database, for example, and they can pull that data into Python, and they can analyze it pretty instantaneously. So that's kind of like the first week. And then there's, you use SQL to bring data sets together, to blend data together to make one big massive table, whether you're making it longer or wider. So that's my first week. And then there's dashboarding where you create these dashboards. It looks like a car dashboard where you have the different charts, right? And they're dynamic because the tables are connected, and the tables usually are like Excel files or something where company data is dumped into the Excel files every night at the close of business. So the next morning, when you open up the dashboard, it repopulates. So it's pretty slick. And that's probably week two. And then week three is like data mining, association mining, where, you know, with numerical variables, you can calculate numerical correlations. But with like text, like product names and invoice numbers, you can't calculate numerical correlations, so you use these a bunch of different probabilities to create a thing called LIFT. And LIFT is just a ratio of probabilities. And if the invoice, if two products have a LIFT of 1, it just means they're not related. But if they have a LIFT of, say, 3, that means they're positively related. If they have a LIFT between 0 and 1, that means they're negatively related. So if you have a positive LIFT on, like, two different kinds of products, two different names of products, you want to display them on the shelf together in your store. So that's a part of marketing analytics. And then we're doing some regression analysis where we're estimating models or probabilities. And then the final week of class is machine learning. We're going to go through a machine learning algorithm. But that's all I've been doing for a year.
So what are you
teaching my classes and then just teaching these data analytics classes. It's pretty fun stuff.
So what do you do with a guy like me who, even if I use the Excel to list a bunch of numbers, I still use my calculator to add them up?
Well, I think you'd enjoy my class because I teach the intuition in Excel. And then in the introductory business analytics class, there's really no coding to do in Python. I give them the code, and then they have to modify the code. I tell them how to modify it, and then they have to, and then they might have to, like, Python's really good at creating charts. So what they do is they modify the code in a way where they can make the chart really pretty, you know, bubbles, you know. So I think you'd enjoy the class because I use Excel to teach the content because Excel is like this very visual platform, right? So
all right.
That's how I teach it. And then I just have them modify code or build these dashboards, which are kind of like Excel on steroids, like Tableau. And
I think I would have to audit this class. I don't think it would be. Like I say, I only use Excel to list numbers, and then I add them up myself. I don't even need it.
Well, if you took my class, you would learn that you didn't need your calculator.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I trust it. I don't trust this new stuff.
If nothing else, Tom, that's what you'd learn. You wouldn't need your calculator if you're using Excel because I teach. I use Excel, and we make the we let Excel make the calculations.
I actually have my huge list of all the stuff I spend on the house for my remodeling. I pull out at the end of the year. I pull out my calculator and add them up. How bad is that? You know what? It works though. I mean, it still works. I mean, it's you know the well, whatever. But I find that, you know, I just wonder. Regression analysis I was used to be pretty good at, but that was 45 years ago. I don't know if I'd still
Well, things have changed a little bit since then. I mean, I think back then you wouldn't want a very big data set, but now, you know, you're doing regressions with 50,000 observations, or in my economic research, I estimate regressions that have millions of people in them from the March CPS supplemental. So, yeah, I think 40 years ago, having a sample size that's pretty small would be a number cruncher. Well, today, you know, computers can do a regression with millions of observations in a matter of seconds. So, it's pretty fun stuff. I really enjoy it.
I took a class. That they actually, all the solving of any of the problems were beyond the scope of the class. All you did was set them up, right? And the book was very small, but it was the most expensive book I ever bought in college.
Oh, yeah.
It was Integer Programming and Network Flows.
Uh-huh.
And the guy who was the professor was into the, evidently, somebody had just gotten to the point where you could make a stab at what he called the hardest problem in mathematics was the salesman coloring problem. Remember that?
I don't remember that, huh?
Well, if you... If you were... And to this day, it's a branch of mathematics that obviously do well in that class, but it has to do with... there's mathematics where you come out with an answer, which is the ones I was always pretty good at that math. You know, the answer is 4. The answer is 5.2. That I could come to, but these are... You use mathematics where if a salesman had to make 15 stops in a day.
Oh, yeah, okay. And you're talking about kind of a delivery problem.
And the idea where you have these constant feints where you go and you pivot, you try this and you try that, and it's this constant redoing and pivoting and going from one to one and realizing where you were and how that's not the way to go. It's sort of a combination of mathematics and a maze.
Well, you know, I think that problem is, like you said, unsolvable, but people who design algorithms, they put... they tagged bees to find out how they would go around and collect pollens off of flowers, and they're trying to model what bees do. So they were studying bees, and they're trying to create an algorithm that, you know, because, you know, millions of years of generations of bees would probably have figured out the best algorithm for that problem. And so they were monitoring bee flights.
Really?
It's pretty interesting stuff, yeah.
So I can see where you would be, I'll use the term fleeing to that kind of things to teach, because that would be very interesting. Plus, it would keep you out of what the Fed and the government's doing to the economy.
Oh, yeah. This has been the hardest year of my life in terms of teaching, because I had 4 classes last semester and 5 this semester. But it's been the most fun because... I can do just what you said. I'm only teaching like 1 econ class a semester, and the rest are business programming or business analytics type of classes. Or I'm teaching business fundamentals too, which is a capstone and for our curriculum in business. So it's been fun to not have to talk about economics, honestly, because I think economics has gotten so political. There's not much room for debate in economics, I don't think, anymore. I think, it's sad, and I sometimes cringe when I'm in my macro class because I'm thinking, man, if I criticize this particular fiscal policy too much, maybe it gets me in trouble. So I'm kind of relieved I don't have to do it.
We just go back real quick to the classes you are teaching. I mean, when I was in my integer programming and network flows, which I never should have been in, there were 12 people. There were me and 11 people that already had, that was going to be like their master's degree with honors, and they had already been hired by Mobile or Exxon or somebody, because those are the people that did that kind of stuff. So what I was doing in there, I have no idea. So the person who's taking this stuff that you're, that pretty high-level stuff, which, you know, I'd be interested in, who's hiring them? I mean, what kind of, where, I mean, what is it, who even would know enough to look for that skill set, I guess, is my question. I mean, insurance companies, I mean, know enough to go get, what do they call the math guys that do all the life and death stuff, what do you call those dudes?
Well, I think Boeing had, like, three golden boys, and they'd play ping pong all day until the engineers came across the problem that they couldn't solve, and they would just then have the guys put down their ping pong balls and go in and solve the problem that the engineers couldn't do. So I think the firms that hire that kind of talent are probably just hedging against the possibility that their awesome engineers run across a problem that they can't fix or solve.
But then when you talk about your regression analysis and the high-end part of that, I mean, the people who hire them, for those that don't, that maybe don't know this, the guys who do that are going to be the guys who run a not a lumber yard, but a sawmill or an oil refinery. Here's the price of gasoline, kerosene, this and the other thing. By the way, this is what we can get out of this great oil. What's the maximum min we can do for all the stuff to give us the most money coming out the back end, right? And that's what those guys do.
Yeah, well, in economics, we use high-level econometrics, and the kind of econometrics I use is not as high-level as that being used at, like, MIT or Harvard. I'm kind of, like, doing my own little thing. I've developed my own series of models to estimate the effects of policy on things like the number of firms in an industry code that are disaggregated by number of employees, and I finished up the work on a paper that looks at Colorado versus Utah's minimum wage law and its effect on firm counts, on the type of firms that hire low wage workers, and it's pretty fascinating stuff, man. And then I use the same kind of methodology to evaluate the effectiveness of Startup New York's enterprise zones on firms in the science and technology industry code and the manufacturing industry code. And actually, both articles, if you read them, you would think that maybe a conservative wrote the minimum wage paper, and then a progressive probably wrote the pro Startup New York paper. But I use the same kind of methodology, the same kind of variables.
Oh, don't tell me you're one of those people that looks at an issue and decides where you are before looking at whether the right or the left.
Oh, no, I just apply a model that I think is good, and just let the model run with the data, and overly torture the data.
No, you can't do that.
I'm not looking for a result. I'm just kind of like letting the data and the model output something, and a lot of times I'm pleasantly surprised by it.
Yeah, but then, see, that's why nobody likes you. But what you're supposed to do is look at it and say, oh, wait a minute, here's where the right would be on this. By the way, I'm a righty, so that's where I am.
Yeah.
Or this is where the left would be, and I'm a lefty, so that's where I am.
You know,
that's what you're supposed to do.
That comes up in my money and banking class. You know, I cover post-Keynesian money supply and neoclassical money supply, and I put those two models of money supply next to a Keynesian agri-demand, agri-supply model or a neoclassical version of that same model, and I go, you know, what's interesting here is if you grow up in the east, on the east side of New York, on the Upper East Side, where you see and you experience government's involvement in the economy, building bridges and subways, if you go off to graduate school, you're probably thinking, I want to work for such a politician. So you're going to gravitate to the post-Keynesian model of agri-demand supply. If you grew up in Idaho and your dad was self-reliant and we didn't need welfare because we had a warehouse of potatoes or pinto beans, and we could eat that all winter long if we ran out of money, and he was self-reliant, he fixed things, he added onto the house, you'd probably be drawn to the more libertarian, and maybe you want to be an advisor to that kind of politician, you'd be drawn to the neoclassical view of money supply and the neoclassical view of agri-demand supply. So I tell my students, it's not our death styles that, or our lifestyles determine our death styles that Metallica sings about. It's our formative years determine our PhD economics, right? So I think if you're looking to be an advisor and you want to help Republicans get elected, your modeling is biased. If you grew up on the Upper East Side of New York City and you want to advise Democrat progressive politicians, your formative years kind of bias your economics. That's why these two sets of economists can't come to an agreement, why they argue so much on TV. And that's why I'm kind of glad I'm stepping away from it and teaching business analytics.
Well, I'm gonna lob one at you here because I know I can always get you involved, even though you don't want to be. I'm going to say that with very rare exceptions, there is no such thing as Keynesian economics.
I think there is Keynesian economics. I think it's I think it's just the way that the modeling is done there is it invites central planning because you aggregate to the country level.
That's not what I meant. What I meant is one versus monetary. I mean, if you look at strict Keynesian formulas, again, you're the mm-hmm. professor, so don't be afraid to wing a hook or a D at me if that's what I deserve here. if you're a strict Keynesian, you're going to go out and say, okay, we do better. We're going to increase spending in the economy because we're going to raise taxes. We're going to take the money, and because the population saves 15-20%, which nobody does anymore, we're going to spend that 15-20%. Like tomorrow, because government doesn't save anything. So all you really pick up in that brand of ball is the 15-20%, and that's now who spends it and other stuff. I'm just talking about the money itself. How do you gain consumption? But right now we're not doing that at all because we're not separating one from the other. We're saying that right now if Biden comes out with his $500 billion plan, there's no way in God's earth that he plans on borrowing that money from the population and spending it. They're talking about printing it. So they can say fiscal policy all they want. It's monetary policy because they're getting the money. What I'm saying, they're right in the last however many years, and actually actual World War II was Keynesian policy. You went out and you sold war bonds and you spent it on the war. You borrowed money from your people. It became an asset on their balance sheet, a liability on the government's balance sheet, but net-net, the house was even, and you spent the money on the war to win it, okay, with no saving, you spent all of it. That's not what we're doing now. We're just printing the dough.
Oh, no.
We're not. Yeah. This is Keynesian in name only.
Yeah, I think it is Keynesian in name only. You know, I think the problem here is you have people who want to advise Republican administration or Democrat administration, and they want to, and they'll compromise their principles, I think, to advise such a person.
You think?
And definitely. I mean, that's one thing I liked about Friedman. He told Reagan, "No, I'm not going to chair your Council of Economic Advisors because then I have to come to a consensus, and I have to bend my principles to that of the committee." And so he'd rather comment from the sidelines, right?
Yep.
And that's where I prefer to be. You know, I don't want to be on a committee of economists because, you know, experts are notoriously bad at being, or really good at being wrong.
But why
experts are experts at being wrong?
But why have we locked ourselves into this? And I'm dragging it toward the political end. I mean, one of the guys who comes on the show every week is Carl Denninger, and you know, people love him or not love him so much, but I've learned tremendously from him, because what I've learned, Hal, and what you do as well, and that's why I've really missed you, is take a much longer view of things. I mean, anybody who looks at what the Fed is doing, or what the labor numbers are, or what's going on, you look at the long-term trends, you can't even tell when one guy's coming in as president and the other guy. I mean, anybody who thinks that Jay Powell is acting any differently for Biden than he did for Trump, he's doing whatever they want him to do. He's just printing money for him. There's no difference. There's no Republican or Democrat there. He whatever they want to do, he spends. He comes up with. I mean, it has nothing to do with. But the nouveau, what I want to get you, maybe we'll do more after the break, but is the new monetarist. It's funny. I looked at when I saw the guy in Turkey. What the hell's his name? Erdogan, or who's the loser that runs the place? Erdogan or something. He fires his central bank hat, right? Because he didn't want interest rates going up. And of course,
yeah.
I immediately go, I'll bet I know what happened over there. So I of course Google Turkish money supply and Turkish interest rates, and sure enough, in the last 5 years, they've had a massive spike in money supply. They got inflation basically out the ass, and the guy's trying to combat it by running the interest rates up, and the guy who's the head of the country is pissed off at him. And I'm saying, you and I could write this script.
History repeats, and repeated history repeats.
We'll go to Iran, we'll go to Argentina, we'll go to Venezuela.
Yeah.
You name it. Same way with Holland, the tulips, you know. I mean, they increased the money supply and everybody bought tulips. I mean, it's always the same story. And yet every time somebody says it's not going to be that way this time.
It's always, history's an important teacher, and that's probably why there's such a push to erase history.
Well, that's right, but can you really?
Well, I mean, I think you can with social media. I mean, if you look at what the Democrat Party's become, I mean, they're the corporatist of today. They're Google, they're YouTube, they're Facebook, they're Twitter, they're Amazon, and all this jawboning between Amazon and Joe Biden is just, in my opinion, theater.
Other than the fact that Trump had somewhat of a cantankerous personality, I'm going to put that out there.
Yeah. Trump lost because he couldn't stay off the Twitter. I mean,
what I'm saying is that
off the Twitter and not rankled so many people. I think there's a good chance that he probably would have won re-election, but I think people are just sick of it.
I think they're
going to get sick of Joe Biden pretty quick. Did you see Joe Biden in that virtual event the other day where he was interacting with this green van company? How do you plug it in? I mean, I think people are going to get sick of that too. So I think Joe Biden is the antidote to Trump, and Trump was the antidote to Obama, and Obama was the antidote to Bush. And it just seems like the guys that are willing that get elected, they're just getting worse and worse and worse.
Well, I guess where I'm going, we're sort of going the same direction. The Amazon. They don't give a rat's behind about Trump or Biden or anybody. They have enough money to be in, and now what do they get? The biggest lobbying effort of anybody or something. It's all about being in, and they don't care. I mean, I have this, my significant other is kind of going right on me, which is okay. Some of her friends are, and last week I was tired of listening to it, to be honest, and I said, what is wrong with you people? Don't you get that the people that have this money, they want to be the emperors of the world. They don't care whether you label them left, right, center, upside down, whatever. They don't care. I mean, the thought that the big companies are for the left, or the people from Hollywood or something,
for power.
It's all for power. They said, well, look what happened to the city of Chicago. I mean, I go, hey, those people are emperors. Don't think for a second that the people who give all the money to the Democrats or whoever, like Lori Lightfoot, aren't themselves Republicans. They don't care. Yeah. They're just paying off the person in power to get what they want. It has nothing to do with it.
That's all they're doing is rent seeking. Right?
Yeah,
they're chipping in because they want their monopoly positions protected. I mean, think about this, Tom. Think about the criticisms of John D. Rockefeller. He's a predatory pricing monopolist. Well, what do you think Google is?
Yeah.
Google's a predatory pricing monopolist that gives it away for free. Well, quote-unquote free. What is YouTube? YouTube's the same thing. Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, they're predatory pricing monopolists. If you don't like John D. Rockefeller, how can you like these big tech companies?
Well, but they've dropped out of, and I'll blab this one out there, we'll talk about it more of a break. The typical antitrust would be Hal Snar bought this other guy's hot dog stand and doubled the prices, so that's how he made his money. But what's happening now is these guys, they lower the prices, get somebody out of business, and then find another way to steal somebody's personal information and sell it, so yeah. The price people think they're paying is actually lower when in fact it's more.
Yeah, and then on top of that, they're in favor of things that would make their competitors go out of business by raising their cost artificially. Like Amazon is in favor of raising the minimum wage.
Well,
right?
That's right. Well,
why? Because it might.
When we come back from break, let's talk about that. SP Futures down 3, NASDAQ Futures down 24. Be right back.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you're aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks,
stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. We have Mr. Hal Snar with us today. We also have Mr. Ian Kidwell on the board, doing a good job. He's improving. It seems like he's not using his toes when I walk by now. He used to use fingers and toes, but he's back to just using him fingers. That's good, Ian. You know,
I was hoping you wouldn't see that.
You know, good to keep the, especially when you're not wearing flip flops. It's not the summer; it's tougher. weekly jobless claims: 547 versus 603 estimate. It still seems awful high for. I was putting like 800,000 jobs to work last month. I mean, something less, Cal, how that matches or doesn't. SP futures down a buck and a half. NASDAQ futures down 13, so we're coming back some here. Dow futures unchanged. Unched, as they used to say in the trading floor. DAX up 87.6%. FTSE up 16.2%. CAC around up 41.7%. We're in Asia. Big bounce back on the Nikkei. It was down a chunk yesterday. Now it's up a chunk. Up 679, up 2.4%. So the U-turn there. Shanghai down 7. They were like unchanged yesterday. They're almost unchanged today. Kind of strange there. Hang Seng up 133.5%. As a way of review, yesterday, Dow up 316. S&P futures up 38. NASDAQ futures up 163. So a big up day after two down days. Now today, we're relatively unchanged. So we're hanging in there. Right now, we got an inside morning, as they say. 10-year 1.57. Bund minus 0.25. Japan positive 0.07. UK positive 0.73. Oil up 17 cents, 61.52. Brent up 8 cents, 65.40. So slow oil market this morning. Natural gas down 2 cents, 266. RBOB unchanged at 198. And we have gold down 679 after a pretty big up move yesterday. Same way with silver down 16 cents, but it was up a chunk yesterday. Copper unchanged at 428. And Bitcoin is down 186 at 55,385. Ian, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Dub Hawks.
Yeah, the Hawks game was exciting, I heard. They won against the Predators, Blackhawks 5.
I heard,
Predators
too, after
4.
I gave up on them.
The White Sox game was postponed, and the Cubs won against the Mets 16-4. And the Bulls lost to the Cavaliers, 105-121. Chicago weather today will be cloudy with a high of 56. No rain and hopefully no snow, but...
Snow last night. Did you see it?
Yeah, I know. I was not. And yesterday, as between the time that I stepped into the building, Greg's building, and got out the elevator into my office, it was snowing.
Yeah.
Which was quite the surprise. But hopefully no more snow today. In Phoenix, it's a high of 83 and sunny. As always, I feel like the weather hardly changes there. And for Chicago traffic, things are going fine, no accidents. Just watch out for that 640 Cubs game tonight.
With nobody going to it.
Yeah, with no one going to it.
We actually have a few people there. So, Hal, a question on minimum wages. Now, if I was a politician, a sleazy politician, I would want, if you were my economic guy, which, of course, you'd be more than welcome to be, you can keep grading me, say, another D-Day, Chief, another Hook Day, I would want the market rate of, entry-level work to be $11, and I'd want the minimum wage to be $7.50. So every year I could campaign on raising the minimum wage 50 cents, and I could get all kinds of kudos and talk about this is an outrageous thing, it has to be higher, and I'll raise it. But I'd never bother anybody or anything. I'd just keep it under the market rate, and nobody would be the wiser of it.
But that's the case in Utah.
Yeah,
that's the case in Utah right now. We don't have a state minimum wage, but man, if you go over and apply for a job at Apollo Burger or at this truck car wash where I get my motorhome washed, they're paying $15 an hour, $10-$15 an hour. The economy in Utah is doing really, really well, right? So that's exactly what's going on in Utah right now.
Well, so
it becomes a political football.
So if you decide it's going to be $20 an hour, well, that's a non-starter. You can't go there. The only time you really make a difference is if you're right near the market rate, and even then, right now we have all kinds of problems. And I honestly believe this, Hal. And again, wing me a D if you want. We have all kinds of problems in that I think the general population, well, they don't understand. Because they don't take economics to heart like you and I do, they honestly don't understand two things. One is that labor, the supply and demand for labor is just another economic good, and it's a supply and demand for the dollars in your pocket. Dollars are just another economic good. They think they're different, and they're not. They're just all goods are different, but they're still akin to the same supply and demand type of issues is corn and wheat, right, which we're used to having being competitive. So the problem you run into is if you're competitive wage is $11, and you try and make your minimum wage like 12. There you run into problems. And most states kind of stay away from that, although they're starting to get near it. But you also have the issue, the issue is that we don't seem to see that the rates for people are going up anywhere near as fast as the prices have really in the last 20 years. I mean, it's not even close to where.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the idea of, you know, some, I use the term bump on CNBC or Fox Business, talking about, well, gee, Joe's got a job. It's $11 an hour. Why is Joe bitching? Well, Joe's bitching because it's $22,000 a year. I mean that's not even an emergency room visit for a hangnail. Who's kidding who?
Yeah.
I mean, we've gone so far beyond in some parts of where we don't count this inflation. I mean, last year, used car prices were up what, 15%? I know somebody who was in a, fortunately they're fine, was in a accident, and the car was totaled, and the insurance company gave them $5,000 more than they paid for the car 9 months ago, and they can't duplicate it. They need another three. It's unconscionable how fast these prices are running up, virtually everywhere.
I think the CPI is calculated in a way to hide it.
Well, absolutely. It's interesting. I don't know if you remember. Probably one of the times you were on, I went through my long dissertation, but I won't again. regarding me essentially being the inflation guy for the MBTA contract at Pullman back in 1977. So I calculated whenever the inflation went up, our price for Boston for the railroad cars went up. But then again, we had to pay the unions more. We had to pay the guys who made the trucks more, the guys who made the air conditioners more. So it was a piggy move up around the bend. But if we got the seats, say, from Hal's seat company, and Hal was dumb enough to not have an escalation clause in that contract, I'm going to say in the 3.5 years, maybe it was, it took us to do that, to deliver that contract, or 3 years, that inflation was up, and this is right in the heart of it, the late 70s, was up 25-30%. So if Hal was dumb enough to not have an escalation clause in your seat contract, I'm going to say, if you're a small company, you just put yourself out of business.
Oh, yeah.
But now, here's the difference, I think, is that because our people, and I use this term flat out, are lying to us, if you and I had the, I don't think they have wooden seats because they'd be flammable, but let's say they did, and we're making seats and there's wood in there, and we've got the bumps in Washington telling us there's no inflation when there is, and you and I are making seats for Pullman, the dear departed Pullman, and the price of lumber is up 100% this year, this CPI, even if we have an inflation clause, that's not helping us because it's telling us we're up 2%. So you're not only are you lying to your population, you're totally screwing up whatever positive that index is supposed to give to people is, you know, what if you're in the used car market and say, well, the inflation rate is 2%, I gotta get more for my car. Well, that's fine, Hal. The price of cars is up 15%. Good luck with that too. I mean, it's a point now where not only is it lying to people, but it's causing damage.
Well, I think the reason why it's going on is because I think that people have figured out what the Fed really does. I think what the Fed really does is it makes the money class moneyed. They have more money.
Right.
That's what the Fed does. And I think that's behind the recent changes to how M1 is calculated.
How do you know? They stopped giving it a weekly.
Yeah, yesterday, for example, I got a chart from a friend of mine who's a PhD professor at Cal State University. He's like, look at M1. And I calculated, it's like, how did it jump up 350% year over year from last February? And then I did some digging, and now they're including savings. They started including savings in M1. So M1 jumped because they started including savings in it. And what that does, it makes M1 and M2 closer. And I think what they're, and they did that during the pandemic when they knew that this fiscal stimulus and this monetary stimulus was going to benefit the moneyed class. I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that it wants to.
How did your buddy find this out? They stopped giving us the weeklies.
Well, he shared the M1 chart with me, and he's like, what is going on here? And yesterday when I tried to figure out why M1 jumped so much, the components, the old components of M1, didn't provide enough elevation to M1 to justify the 350% increase. So I did some digging on the Federal Reserve's website, and lo and behold, I found this chart that showed them moving savings quietly over to M1.
Well, okay, if you mind if I take a second and give the history to this. For those that are up there in years, you know, what's the difference between your checking account and your savings account? Well, your savings account, if you read the fine print, if something happened to the bank, they could actually put a hold on that for, what, 30 days?
Yeah.
Well, your checking account was in fact a demand deposit. So one was considered back in the 30s and the 20s when Friedman was writing The History of Money, was considered hot money, right? So, but here also I think is what happened in the last couple of months, Hal, and it's a real simple explanation, is because people got their $1,400 checks dumped right in their checking account. That's why it blew up in the last month or two.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think a lot of people are probably saving or paying off debt. So
no, I'm saying
savings going on.
I'm saying that money. Yeah. If they sent you a check, okay, you might have actually, well, you can't deposit it directly at PTI, but you might have essentially put that in your brokerage account or anything. But for most people, they didn't send you a check. The $1,400 appeared in your checking account.
Yeah.
Which is M1. Right. I mean, traditionally it's been M1, but now your savings account. Most places, if you write a check on your checking account for $500 and you've got $400 in there, they're automatically going to move the $100 from your savings account and it's not going to bounce. So in essence, your savings accounts, since they don't pay any interest anymore, have become demand deposits.
Yeah, I think I agree with it too, but you know, I never heard the Fed announce that they're doing this. I mean, all of a sudden M1 is a few trillion dollars lower than M2. It goes from $4 trillion to $18 trillion in less than a year, and there's a huge spike in M1, and people are thinking, is that a result of the fiscal stimulus? Well, there is some of that, but it's just now they've included savings in M1, which I'm okay with. It just makes this seem weird that they did it during the pandemic.
Well, your M1 got to be real low because nobody kept any money in her checking account.
Yeah.
I got a question for you. Here's one. I'm going to test you. I get to test the professor after a year. I happen to know the answer to this. What is M0?
M0? You know, I'm not sure. Honestly, I'm not sure.
I get the one on you. That never happens. It's my
lucky. I know what monetary base, M1, M2, they've discontinued M3. But, yeah, what is M0?
My buddies the Fed tell me. And for a while, you talk about M1. It is money that's in the system. Remember how for a long period of time the idiots, the Fed, were pouring money into the system so much, but they were paying interest to send it back to the Fed at night, right? So there was huge deposits back at the Fed by member banks. So they basically, when they raised the federal funds rate, there is no Fed's funds rate. There is probably still, but there's no. What Fed funds are supposed to be is if a bank, say Northern Trust, doesn't have enough reserves overnight, they can borrow them from Citi or Chase. And that money at night going back and forth is the Fed funds rate, or what banks will pay each other for excess reserves overnight, correct?
Yeah.
Well, they poured so much money in the system that they essentially obliterated the Fed funds. So banks had so much, they were giving the money back to the Fed overnight and getting paid like a percent interest, even though the Fed was giving it to them for free. So that is known as M0.
Money, really? Money
in circulation put on deposit at the Fed at night. And one of my guys at the Fed told me for a period of time, like a few years ago, M0 was greater than M1. There was so much money
totally
in the system.
I agree with that,
I mean, how scary is that?
That's just a result of the Fed paying interest on reserves starting in October 2008.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That created unemployed reserves. I called it unemployed reserves.
Yeah, well, it's M0.
Put a price floor on reserves, right? So it just created the surplus or unemployed reserves. So I call it unemployed reserves.
But you compete. All they did was compete with the Fed funds rate. So
yeah,
I mean, they essentially were saying instead of Northern Trust borrowing up from Chase, Chase turns around and gives it back to the Fed. So there's no place. That's why the guys had to use the discount window when they shouldn't have had to.
Yeah,
I mean, they basically screwed the whole thing up.
Well, that's why they can get rid of excess reserves now that's why they can get rid of the reserve requirement because they have the price floor on the federal funds rate set at interest on reserves.
Yeah.
The interest on reserves is the minimum wage in a labor market, right? So that's why you don't need reserve requirements anymore.
Well, so to get around to the idea of the minimum wage piece, I mean, we clearly, Hal, you know the history of this. I mean, the reason why... Well, I'm not going to say the reason why, but that Roosevelt got rid of child labor was say one part he didn't want 14-year-old girls working in factories, but really wanted those people out of the labor market. So if you took the supply out, people would have to pay more for the rest of the people. Correct?
Oh, I totally agree with that. Yeah.
And so we've had this issue where we've offloaded, you know, the police. Matter of fact, I'm sitting here kind of seething this morning watching Joe Biden talk about he's going to get rid of 50% of the greenhouse gases in 10 years or 15 years, whatever the hell it is.
Well, markets are kind of taking care of that. People are shifting.
Well, they are, but I mean...
CO2 emissions are way down from peaks in 2000.
Well, it's going that way sort of anyway, but the idea of shifting the business to Mexico, where they pour it in the air there rather than here... I mean,
or China.
I mean, what we've essentially done is we've offloaded our labor and our pollution. I mean, that's what we've done, which is idiocy. I mean,
that's why I say environmentalists aren't conservationists. I'm a conservationist. I'm not an environmentalist. I want to conserve the environment. I don't want to make the environment better in the United States and make it worse in China or Mexico.
But they're willing to do that. I mean,
yeah, I know. Yeah, that's why they're not conservationists, in my opinion.
No, they're not. I mean, I mean, when you get back to the minimum wage piece, I mean, when you start to get on the bubble, but there's all kinds of parts to this. I mean, I haven't been able to tell you any of these stories. I haven't seen you in a while, but one of my buddies is he's a blaster. He likes to hunt, and he's a butcher, and he's does fine dining and burgers and everything. But he was telling me that he had his restaurant that he opened. It's, you know, poor guy. It was like a year before the COVID thing. I hope they're still in business, but I don't know. And you know, and you pay huge leases for these places. I mean, the lease prices are high. And all of a sudden he couldn't find people to work there at, you know, whatever he had budgeted, say $11 an hour. And he said, you know, I just can't find anybody to work. And I said, well, how much are you paying? He says, well, $11 an hour. That's like the going rate. I'm thinking, I don't want to give this guy an economics lesson, but I said, how about you said like $13.50?
Yeah, you got to overcome that.
He goes,
unemployment insurance.
He goes,
then
I wouldn't have a problem. And then he goes, then I wouldn't have a problem. And I said, okay, well, now that's point one. Now, point two, the guy's name's Alan. He's been on the show. He's a terrific guy. I said, Al, if you'd have known, I said, the problem is that the $13.50 is the last fat guy at the end of the bench, right? And he goes, well, what do you mean? I said, well, it's the one you're looking at now. It's why people look at their gas purchases as being inflation because they're paying it and it's right there in front of them at the pump. Where in fact, it's not anywhere near what you pay the most on per month unless you're a salesman or something. But if you'd have known that you were going to pay $13.50 when you negotiated the lease, would you have had a less lease? He goes, well, absolutely. I said, well, therein lies the rub. I mean, you're blaming it all on the poor guy making $2.50 more an hour when, in fact, your lease is too high. And he goes, well, if you look at it that way, I said, well, how else can you look at it? I mean, you put all these prices down, you thought they were sacred, and said, okay, I can pay $20,000 a month for this shack. Where, in fact, if those prices were different, you'd have said, I can pay $17 a month for this shack.
Yeah.
You know, so it's... And I think that caught a lot of people. You know, I mean, true. I mean, it's, but because I have to believe, Hal, that wherever you and I work, if they're paying us $10 an hour, I don't care if we're serving coffee, we're going to be worth more to that place than $10 an hour. Right. I mean, the idea of it that the Walmarts and the Amazon get away with paying these prices. I mean, what is the, you know, the formula better than me? You pay the last person. What is it? Their marginal benefit to the place, right?
Yeah.
I mean, your first employee that you're paying $20 an hour is probably worth $300 an hour. The second guy's worth, you know, $250, and you should be hiring the last guy you hire. You should be getting like $20.50 out of his excess work, right? And you're paying him $20. Isn't that still the theory that I learned?
Well, the way I teach labor demand is that it's the value you place on the applicants. So your number one applicant for a job is going to be the leftmost point on the labor demand curve, whereas the person with the least valuable job skills, the value of his work per hour is going to be over on the right side of the labor demand curve, right? So you put people in a queue and you line them up according to their and you try to figure out what their value is by their applications and their work histories and their letters of recommendation. So that populates. That's how I teach labor demand. That populates the labor demand curve, right?
Well, and right now you've got issues where people with college degrees that are would be worth something to somebody aren't getting that job, and all of a sudden they're tending bar or doing something. I mean, or they're waitressing or doing something. So I mean, you've got this total disconnect. You know, even in the Silicon Valley, where you're bringing people from China over and you're paying them $60,000 a year, and moving out the people here who probably would be making 80 because you can get, I use that indentured servitude line, you can get those people here and they can't go to another company and get paid more.
But I think the reason why that is because colleges in the United States have turned into credential mills. That's it. I mean, you know, so you create a bunch of people who have credentials, but have you created a productive labor force? I don't think so.
Well, I think we have too big of a labor force. I mean, and a lot of that has to do with
we have a credentialed labor force with very low practical job skills, in my opinion, right?
Well, where do you stand? I mean, this is we have a few minutes left. Where do you stand on the Milton Friedman idea that he talked about in class a lot, that if he ever had 3 or 4 months where he could do nothing, he would actually try and do the math on whether two things. One, if a monopoly was actually better than a cartel. And he thought maybe it was, but his idea was that companies can be too big. He would say, like, if who bought Squibb? Was it Bristol Myers? I mean, the companies were both big enough to have all the right, if you go from a 20,000 person firm to a 40,000, he says you actually can get to the point where you get less efficient rather than more.
Well, I think the reason why that happens is because I think in these big corporations, people want to preserve their positions, and I think there's more herding going on where you have to think similar ideas, and I think that's what's happening at Google and these other places. You can only have one point of view at these places, and when that happens, you kind of poison the business, and you think your position, your market position gives you kind of a moral hazard. It creates a moral hazard where you think you can be political, but when you start discriminating against people for viewpoints or whatever reason, competitors won't, and they'll jump in and they'll take you down. And I think that's one reason why J.D. Rockefeller's empire fell, because he didn't see, he was slow to see the disruption that was coming with the automobile, right? And his competitors didn't. So I think when you have lots of groupthink, where people are thinking very alike, you don't realize that you're setting the stage for a major disruption where your competitors are going to come in and sell to your customers and to the customers getting discriminated against, because maybe they don't have the same views, or they don't look right, whatever discrimination you're engaging in, your competitors won't. And that's why I think monopolies fall over time.
Well,
they look like they're invincible in the short run, but they're not. Everything's adjustable over the long run.
But his point, which he never had a chance to try and prove, was that, say, you know, Bristol Myers and Squibb got together, that he thought in terms of he wasn't a social guy at all, but he would have said that at the end you were better off leaving them apart, because them being competitive, way more jobs, way more and better drugs, because there was competition.
And yeah, the competition leads to innovation.
Yeah, that's
right?
What that is his point. That's what is his point. That you not only had way more people employed, that if you're one firm, you look at the other firm and say, I can get rid of half those people. It didn't actually work that way. You ended up getting rid of the people who ended up being your best, and instead of having, you know, I'm not going to say a cure for cancer, but the to get rid of your competition virtually in every business, any business, you're better off with some competition. You're better off with 10 oil companies than 4.
Yeah, but I think most people, human nature, they want protection from competition.
Well,
it doesn't matter if it's a blue-collar worker or a corporate CEO or a politician. They want protection from competition, and usually they in America, they rent seat. They ask the politician for that protection, right? Because I think most people are like Kevin in Mr. Wonderful in Shark Tank.
Yeah.
They want the market protection, right?
You're not like
Mark Cuban, who aren't afraid of competition.
Well, you know who you're quoting, by the way. You sound just like him. Although you're not as tall, you're not as tall as George Stigler.
How tall is George Stigler?
Well, he was huge. He's taller than me, and I was 6'4".
Oh, wow.
I mean, he's like 6'5", and I'm thinking Milton Friedman was like 5'4".
Oh, wow.
And they were like the best of friends.
Well, you remember Milton Friedman at the Nobel Prize where he got protested by that one protester?
Oh.
He's wearing his tuxedo, and he's this little short guy. And I think the king of Sweden was probably over 6 foot tall, and the difference in their heights was.
Oh yeah, he's a little dude,
right?
But George Stigler said, "Remember, competition is the greatest thing for every industry except yours. But in your industry, it's cutthroat competition, and we got to do something about it."
Well, it's right. He's right.
He's absolutely right.
I mean, competition makes us better.
Yeah, but not in my industry. But these are good prices. These are solid prices. Blah blah blah. Right.
I want free markets, but not in the markets that I sell.
Oh, not in mine. Oh, got it. Let's say you wanted 50 more professors at this university. We don't need those guys.
Well, look at the University of Utah economics professors. They're outraged by the fact that the Koch Brothers organization came in and created a kind of a institute for economic research. They're happy with that competition.
Oh, God, no. All right, hell, we got to go. We can't go long having you back, buddy. You're the best. SP Futures down 2, NASDAQ Futures down 19. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex. Offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit hamzyanalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.